I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the internet entrepreneur Kevin Ryan. Kevin is the founder of Ally Corporation, a network of internet companies including Guilt Group, the luxury e-commerce community, TenGen, an open-source database, and The Business Insider, an online news site for the technology and media industries. Kevin was formerly the CEO of DoubleClick, an online advertising company that was eventually sold to Google for $3.5 billion. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'd like to start with a short history of e-commerce, which you helped to pioneer almost accidentally in 1995 when you were working at a company called United Media. Mm-hmm. What was the landscape of the internet?
So there was very little there. Don't forget, it was pre-Google. There were hardly any search engines. There was very little e-commerce, and there was very little advertising. So there's probably about $50 million worth of advertising, I think, in 1995, so tiny. But what I could see in 1995, which changed my career, is it was growing like crazy. And every single person I spoke to who'd gone online loved it. And all of a sudden you could imagine, which is obvious now, that everyone would be online and every business would be online.
United Media owned the rights to comic strips like Dilbert and Peanuts, you know, Snoopy. And the company traditionally tried selling these comic strips to newspapers, but you helped to create an online presence. What's the story there?
So the story there is that I had started the Dilbert website. And so we really had a challenge because we had trouble selling our comic strips all over the country. We couldn't go around because there's only one newspaper in every town. So we said, look, if we could go directly to the consumer, it'd be great. It sounds obvious now. You go online. We set up the Dilbert website. And on the Dilbert website, sold advertising and set up an e-commerce site so we could sell T-shirts and ties and things like that. And it turned out to be a big success, and it really changed my career.
Now, you approached the company, United Media, and you said, why don't we start an online advertising company? But they denied you, and in that was this opportunity.
Yeah, more the parent company, Scripps, just was concerned, as all companies are, about cannibalizing their business, because if the website was successful, then the business of selling the comic strip to the newspapers might go away. And so that's harmful. The other thing is that a lot of people weren't sure that the internet was going to be successful. I had more than one person tell me at the time, this could be the new CD-ROM, which had been hot 3 years before and then was fading. In retrospect, it's obvious. It wasn't completely obvious at the time.
And to what extent was your motivation for leaving just a personal one that, you know what, I've enjoyed my stay and now I'm looking for something else?
I realized I was on this progression of wanting more and more control over what I did. Now I really wanted to be somewhere where, for better or worse, I could make the decisions and move forward.
You graduated from Yale in 1985, and you were an investment banker at Prudential, and you spent some time at Euro Disney prior, and then United Media. And then you leave to get involved in this desert of e-commerce, which was quickly becoming more populated. And you were introduced to DoubleClick. How did you find DoubleClick?
So I found DoubleClick because I was looking around at many companies. Because I knew I'd made the decision I wanted to go work in the internet full time. And I was thinking about starting a company that might have been similar to DoubleClick. And as I went out and met the guys who had started DoubleClick for part of my competitive research, I realized that they were very smart, both had engineering backgrounds, very technical, and had created something that I had no idea how to create. And I thought, wait a second, maybe I should partner with them. They had the same thought. And interestingly, 16 years later, I'm still working with one of those two guys in all of my startups. So it's been a long-term relationship for all three of us.
Can you describe briefly what DoubleClick is?
So the DoubleClick, the ad-serving company, was really a company that provided a technology tool for businesses that allowed them to manage all the internet advertising. So if you were the Wall Street Journal, you used our tool to serve up dynamically one ad for you and different ad for me, even though we show up on the same page. The important thing there, let me give an example. A car company wants to advertise on Wall Street Journal. Because of the DoubleClick tool, they could make sure that their ads are only seen by people in the United States, not by someone who comes in from France. They don't want to reach the person in France because they don't sell the same car in France.
You went to DoubleClick first as the president, and you became the CEO. And during that time, you had a real kind of seminal pivot point where you were switching from a predominantly sales-based advertising model to one of ad servicing. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, because very few companies have ever made this transition. We had started by using our technology tool to create a network where we could sell advertising. So by 2000, we had 600 people worldwide selling advertising. And when we went public, it was 90% of our business. Mm-hmm. And within a year or two, though, I realized that I just didn't feel like that business was ultimately going to be profitable.
Even though it was 90% of your revenue.
Yeah. And so can you imagine as a public company trying to transition off 90% of your business? Mm-hmm. It's hard for public shareholders to understand that. Mm-hmm. So, but our technology business kept growing, and I really thought it had long-term potential. And so over a 2.5-year period, we actually sold off and got out of the ad sales business and then transitioned into the technology business. Mm-hmm. It was very different, hundreds of engineers. And so that ultimately, I think, made the difference and was why DoubleClick was worth billions of dollars.
When you did make the shift, were you feeling simultaneously that, yeah, this feels right? Because you went through a couple of rocky periods in that time.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a terrible period. Actually, what helped us was that the internet collapsed.
How come?
Since everyone's stock was collapsing, everything looked terrible. It was hard to know what to compare things to, you thought, well, there's nothing to lose. When things are going badly, you feel bolder and make better decisions. You know, the challenge that many companies have today is that their business may be declining if they're in radio or if they're in magazines, but not so much that they feel the need to do something dramatic. And they just sort of slowly wither away. And that's the worst.
Whereas in your situation, everything was dramatically collapsing. So what the heck?
Exactly. You know, 70% of our clients went bankrupt in a 2-year period.
DoubleClick had, through your 9-year tenure, quite a volatile existence. You had 7 rounds of layoffs.
Yes. So first we went from 0 to 2,000 people in 4 years. Then, you know, the 7 rounds of layoffs. Investigation by the FTC and by, Elliot Spitzer on privacy issues, which were later dropped, but still, you know, are very difficult to go through. Beaten up in the press quite a bit. The stock price going from 120 or 130 down to $5 is a pretty ugly time period. You run into public shareholders who, you know, remind you all the time that they bought the stock at 80 and it's now 10. Just the fact that you point out that the entire sector went down doesn't make them feel any better. They tell you, well, I didn't buy the sector. I bought DoubleClick. I remember going on an earnings call once, and as I'm talking, you can see in the chat groups on Yahoo Chat, you know, this, Kevin is blathering on about some another quarterly miss or, you know, problem. When is it going to stop? You know, it's hard to fight through that.
You stayed at DoubleClick for roughly 9 years. At what point during that period were you feeling ready to move on?
By every measure, except for, the stock price, things were great. Mm. So once we right-sized the business and we're building, we were enormously profitable. Completely separate to that, I felt like after being there 9 years, I feel like I should have left after 7.5 years, only because just for me, I need more variety.
What were you flirting with doing, even though you were still at the company? Mm-hmm. What did you think you wanted to do afterwards?
I hadn't crystallized my thinking at year 8. By year 9, I realized there were sort of 3 choices. One would be to go run another large internet company in New York, but that didn't actually exist. DoubleClick was by far the biggest company. Second would have been to go more on the financial side of setting up a VC firm or a private equity firm. So I thought about that. And the third would be to start, other internet companies.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the internet entrepreneur, Kevin Ryan. Kevin is the founder of Gilt Group, which started in 2007 as an invitation-only flash sale site for discounted luxury apparel and accessories for women. Kevin was the CEO of DoubleClick, an online advertising company that was eventually sold to Google for $3.5 billion. I'd like to talk about your childhood for a moment because, in a way, that period informed your professional life to some extent. Mm-hmm. You spent a number of years in Europe.
Yep.
What brought you to Europe?
My family's from the Midwest. My father joined Caterpillar, the ultimate Midwest company, and they send their executives abroad. And so when I was 5, we went to Rome for 2 years, and then from there went to Geneva for 5 years. So my childhood was really mostly in Geneva, and then when we came back in high school, we were outside of Cleveland in Chagrin Falls, Ohio.
Was your father, it seems like he was a big company man, like a good soldier working for Caterpillar.
What is interesting, my father, who up until a couple of years ago had worked for just 2 companies in his life, about 25 years for each one. But all 3 of his sons are entrepreneurs, and all 3 of his sons have started at least 1 company.
And it's so ironic to me that Caterpillar could not be more capital intensive and heavy, palpable stuff. And you and your brother, one works for Facebook, are dealing with air.
Yes, absolutely. It's just it's a different time. You know, all of us like doing our own thing, and you can't start your own car company or mm-hmm. your own, you know, heavy machinery company easily. Mm-hmm. But we grew up at a time when you could do some very interesting things and move very quickly in the internet space.
And what about your mother?
So my mother is very interesting. She has 4 or 5 degrees and so had multiple careers. She went back to law school when I was in high school mm-hmm. and then worked for 15 years. And now for the last 10 years has had yet another career. She is involved in rare books. So mm-hmm. has 16,000 books out of her apartment and has an online internet business. And both my parents today work probably 40 or 50 hours a week.
I mentioned before that your time in Europe helped to inform your professional life. And one example of that is when you were in France, you learned about flash sales mm-hmm. in Europe, which create an urgency and a scarcity for items. Talk to me about that exposure.
You know, the largest internet company by far in France is called Vente Privée. And so everyone in France knows them and they do flash sales. And so it really just struck me in the United States as I was always thinking about new business ideas that there'd never been a successful internet idea in the United States that came from abroad. Mm-hmm. And this is just one. And I couldn't think of why it would work elsewhere but not work in the United States. So after I thought about this concept for a couple of weeks, I thought, well, I can't think of a good reason, so I'm going to start it myself.
Vente Privée has a partnership with American Express as it attempts to have a presence in the United States. It was founded by the entrepreneur Jacques-Antoine Grandjean.
Grandjean.
Yeah, and they have about $1 billion in sales. Do you have a relationship with him, given that you are in similar businesses?
Yeah, no, we've never met, but I've certainly watched the business from afar for a long time.
You alluded to this before, but it happened in a reverse manner in a way. Most European companies get inspiration from U.S. internet mm-hmm. companies, and here you were seeing a European company and wanting to start one in the U.S. Yeah. Skype is another example.
Yeah, actually, there are an increasing number. I mean, Spotify would be the other example right now of a company that's doing $1 billion in revenue and started in Europe, a music streaming company. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said there aren't that many really interesting, innovative ideas coming out of Europe because they were probably 5 years behind. Now it's not the case. The internet scene in Europe, in particular in Berlin, is doing extraordinarily well. And so you're going to see more billion-dollar ideas come out of Europe.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the internet entrepreneur, Kevin Ryan. We'll hear more from Kevin coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the internet entrepreneur, Kevin Ryan. Kevin is the founder of Ally Corporation, a network of internet companies including Guilt Group, the luxury e-commerce community, TenGen, an open source database, and The Business Insider, an online news site for the technology and media industries. Kevin was formerly the CEO of DoubleClick, an online advertising company that was eventually sold to Google for $3.5 billion. So you looked at Vente Privée and thought, well, why not do this in the United States? Mm-hmm. But then there was more of a moment of clarity on 18th Street in New mm-hmm. York City. What happened there?
I was walking by from my subway stop to the office, and I saw 200 women waiting in line, and it wasn't that great a day. And so I just thought, what are they waiting for? This is a long line. And they were waiting for a sample sale. We were waiting for a half an hour, an hour, just to be able to get in and get clothing at 60% off.
At Marc Jacobs.
And all I could think of at the time was, wait a second, you know, there's 200 women here, but maybe there are hundreds of thousands of women somewhere in this country right now, like in the Midwest. We could be in Westchester, but they could also be literally a block away, you know, and they just are working. And so they can't be in that line, although they're secretly thinking, I'm in a boring meeting right now. I'd rather be in that line. and I can bring it to them.
I want to talk about the early days of mm-hmm. Guilt. You know, it was challenging convincing fashion designers to sell their excess inventory to you because people don't want to publicly admit that they're selling their items at a discount. But who was the first fashion designer to jump on board with you?
So Zach Posen was the first sale. And so we had 50 dresses. And we had very few members. In the beginning, we had, you know, several thousand members, which were really just our friends and anyone we'd ever met. Mm-hmm. And so it was not everyone said yes. Lots of people said no in the beginning from the fashion community. But having said that, a lot of them said yes. And what they liked about the model was that it was closed so mm-hmm. that you couldn't, your average consumer didn't know that this dress had been offered at 70% off.
It was closed because the site was invitation only.
Yeah. And there were just not that many people on the site. Mm-hmm. So it was quite private. It was really very similar to a private sale if you did it, you know, in a warehouse and invited your friends.
Mm. Now, you mentioned Zach Posen, the fashion designer, but it was actually Zach Posen's mother who helps him run the company, who had confidence in you to do this.
It absolutely was. And she was at my house last night. And we will always feel loyal to both to her and to the brand mm-hmm. for being the first sale for us.
So in addition to having buy-in from the fashion community little by little, you were also helped by the downturn in 2008. How come?
To some degree. People always think that we started in the downturn, and they forget that our first 9 months when the company just exploded mm-hmm. was during not during the downturn at all. It was before Lehman Brothers had crashed. And so it was growing like crazy. But no question, in a downturn, there are more inventory available. And so sometimes it's easier to get inventory. But it's counterbalanced by there are some people who shop less in a downturn. You know, we've had consumers call, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and say, my husband lost his job. I'm going to close down my account because I just can't buy anything else.
You are a founder of Gilt Group. Mm-hmm. In addition to a few other folks, a large team gets mm-hmm. this kind of top billing. In addition to you, there's Alexis Maybank and Alexandra Wilkis Wilson mm-hmm. and Dwight Merriman.
And Mike Brzezik and Fong.
You, though, came up with the idea, yeah. and your first hire were computer engineers.
Yes, yeah. Mike
come?
And Fong. Oh, because once you have the idea, you think, okay, what is going to take the longest period of time? You sort of back into what you need. And so building the site takes longer than actually getting the merchandise. So I went out and hired Mike. Mike found Fong. And then a couple months later, brought Alexis on board. And a couple months after that, brought Alexandra on board.
At this point, you're doing several hundred million dollars in revenue, and as a much larger company, you have, you know, different challenges, and, you know, there's inventory and logistical issues. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of Amazon 5 years mm-hmm. into their life to some degree when they had fulfillment hiccups or challenges. In what way have you thought of Amazon as some type of benchmark?
Yeah, no, we think of Amazon all the time, and I think Amazon, and I think Jeff Bezos is the greatest internet CEO out there. We've been lucky, you know, we haven't had distribution problems at all, and that can bring down companies. And it was one of the things I was very nervous about when I launched it, especially since I had no background in it myself. But we have a fantastic facility, costs are down, so that's a real strength for us. Mm. In fact, to the point where many brands have approached us and asked us if we would take over their e-commerce operations. This mm-hmm. is one of the things we think about long term, is whether we should add that to our business.
You have started a men's brand on the site, Park and Bond. It reminds me of, there was this New York Times article about the death of the cyber flaneur. You know, a flaneur is somebody who likes to browse and mm-hmm. walk along the sidewalks of Paris. And now the internet has become so search-oriented. You're on a mission for shoes, and you go to Zappos and you buy those shoes. And this is such a generality, but men are considered more to be, you know, very search-oriented, whereas women are more kind of the browsing type.
Yeah.
But this line, this retailing line, is kind of, you know, bringing back the flaneurs, turning men into a flaneur to some degree. Have you thought about that kind of behaviorally, how you are affecting, you know, the behavioral psychology mm-hmm. a little bit?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Gilt is that, you know, most e-commerce sites historically are based on search. So you go to Amazon, you know what you're looking for. You don't just wander around. And Gilt did not have search. You had to rely on us showing you interesting things. And the key was not to show you too much. Because if I show you 10,000 white shirts, it's confusing. Whereas I show you just three and they're great, you'll probably choose one. So Park and Bond is really closer to a department store. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that men in particular would say, you know, I love Gilt. I've been on there and we have a huge business. But once in a while, I just need a pair of black socks or I need a shirt. And you may have it that day, but you may not. So I'd love to have both things available, the mm-hmm. opportunistic purchase and then the directed purchase as well. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to take advantage of the fact that, you know, as of a year ago, there were no men's department stores, mm-hmm. You know, anywhere. When you think about it, they're all subsets of women's department stores. And so I think there's an opportunity to build something that's very big.
One of the characteristics of Guild Group is you know the profile of the user whom you've invited, and you show them certain items. How do you make use of that data? How are you able to manipulate that?
So this is one of the most interesting things we do at Guild, and is one of the reasons that online has advantages over a traditional store. You know, if you and I go into a department store, we're obviously going to see the same thing. But in fact, you know, if someone knew each one of us, you would have shown different clothing to you than to me. Most people don't realize on Guild, every day I actually see a different site than you do. I have different sales that are shown to me. My email is different than you because we've prioritized some sales for me, but different ones for you.
And how are you learning that from me?
I'm doing that because when you have a site that where you have to sign in, it means that we have a record of every single site, every single page you've ever looked at on Guild. Doesn't matter what computer you're on. But as long as you're signing into Guild, so we can see that you have size 8 shoes, or we can see correlations between this brand and another brand. So over time, what I really want to do, and we're only 20% of the way there, is really have your own personal site and really only show you 10 things, but they're the right 10 things. So I have full-time teams on this, just building algorithms.
I wonder if it will ever go too far where people don't want the personalization to some extent.
You can also turn it off if you want to. But where people get uncomfortable, which is something that we don't do, but they get uncomfortable if your data is being shared to other places you don't know. So as long as it's creating a better shopping experience for you on the site, then it's beneficial.
You are part of a lot of sea changes going on, whether it's in the mobile space or in bricks and mortar, retail. What impact is e-commerce having on mobile, for example?
Yeah, so what you're starting to see across the board is that the mobile percentage of total is just growing dramatically. So within a period of probably 4 years, it'll go from zero to probably 60% of all purchases.
So what you're saying is instead of people buying items on their computers, they're buying them from their iPhones or their PDAs.
Yeah. And so what you're now starting to see are things that are adapted purely for the iPhone or the iPad. And I can say that I think the best shopping experience for Guild is actually on the iPad because the resolution is so good, because you can do some things with the screen and your fingers that you couldn't do elsewhere. You can drag and drop. So it's a remarkable experience. And it's to think that I was in a meeting earlier today where we referred to the website to us as being something like the old site or the traditional site already. It's almost becoming traditional media.
Not to speak of the Nordstrom's and the Macy's and the Bloomingdale's of the world. What's to happen with real estate?
So I don't think that goes away. I think what's happening is all of the growth is being sucked out of the retail space and it's going online. So obviously if there's $200 billion worth of retail purchases occurring online, that would have occurred in a store. You know, and that happened within 10 years, and $200 billion is not insignificant.
So that's why Nordstrom's is buying a Hot Look.
Hot Look, and just invested in Bonobos.
Hot Look being a competitor to Guild.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think in general, what we're always seeing is the same pattern that we saw with the New York Times or Time Warner or the department stores is the traditional players are moving slower, and they're moving slower than they should because in the beginning it doesn't seem profitable, and they do a little bit and they feel good about it, but they're never the leaders. No one ever says that site from a department store is the best site I've ever seen. They're not aggressive enough generally to buy anyone, so they just sort of fall behind a little bit. The irony always is, and we've seen it every time, that it is better to not have a traditional store or a traditional magazine to be successful online. You think it would give you a big advantage, but in fact, you see every time that it slows you down because you just can't start thinking with a new mentality because you're so worried about ad pages in your magazine. You're worried about cannibalization. You know, you're worried about your store. And so that's where your energy goes. And that creates opportunities for people like me.
And that brings us full circle to United Media, which was afraid to invest in Dilbert.com further.
Absolutely.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Kevin Ryan, the founder of a network of internet companies, including the Business Insider, an online news site for the technology and media industries, TenGen, an open source database company, and the Guild Group, a luxury e-commerce company. In addition to Guild, another company you've launched is TenGen, which is an open source database company, and the product that you offer is MongoDB. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what this company does?
Sure. So this is obviously completely different than Gilt. It's a very, very technical product. And what it is, it's an open source database. So it's the core database that many, many companies use out there. Probably 10,000 companies are using this around the world.
Such as?
So, you know, there are companies like eBay or Disney or AOL or, you know, Groupon. These are all companies that use it in some form, Foursquare. There are security agencies, governments around the world, startups everywhere.
Now, what exactly does it do?
It stores data. So every single site needs at least one database, but generally multiple databases, to store either traffic information, customer information, anything they're capturing. And so this is just easier, faster, allows you to manipulate your data very quickly.
And open source so that others can contribute to the betterment of the database.
Exactly. And so it is open source, which means that it's free for anyone to download. And then we get paid because many companies would like to have support or training. Once you become dependent on the database, you really need to make sure that if there's a problem, like you do something wrong, you want to be able to call us so we can fix that and fix it pretty quickly.
How did you come up with the idea for TenGen?
So this is another example of a pivot. So, you know, when we came up with this, and Dwight Merriman, who's been my partner in all these businesses, is really the driver of this. He has a technical background, and he and Elliot Horowitz have been doing most of the work on this. And the idea, in the beginning, we thought that cloud computing was a fundamental trend, and so we were building out many components, of which the database is one, to build a cloud computing business. And then we realized that the database was just doing extremely well, that there were some breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we decided to actually focus more on the database and not on the other things.
Dwight Merriman features prominently in your life as a co-founder. Mm-hmm. What is he like?
So Dwight is, as you can imagine, incredibly smart, someone who's very technical, someone who really still codes 3 or 4 hours a day. What makes Dwight different than most technical co-founders is he is incredibly brilliant on the business side as well. Now, he doesn't actually like to do all these things. Like, you know, if I said to him, why don't you come to a party where we can meet lots of customers, he doesn't really like to do that much. Right. He'd rather send me.
But he's not in a hole from a business perspective.
No, not at all. But I end up being much more frontward facing. Right. And Dwight, I argue sometimes, is the brains behind the operation, and I'm just the looks. Now, everyone laughs at that for good reason.
because you're so handsome and charming.
Yeah, so that's what makes it funny for them, because I'm not. But but Dwight actually is the brains behind many of the products that we've developed.
Where is he from?
He's actually from Ohio. Actually, the third co-founder of DoubleClick was from Ohio as well.
So what is it about the Midwest, you think?
I think it may be a coincidence. There are smart people everywhere. But it's funny that a lot of the people in the companies I've started have ended up being from the Midwest.
Dwight Merriman, anything else there? I'm kind of intrigued by him.
Yeah, no, Dwight. So one of the things unusual about Dwight is as of 15 years ago, he didn't know anything about wine. I don't think he'd ever had a lot of wine before coming to New York. And now he is, you know, one of the collectors of wine and one of the most knowledgeable people about wine. And in fact, on top of that, has actually opened a restaurant, which is, and you can quote me on this, the best restaurant in all of New York City. It's called Aterra. There's no menu. It's one of the most brilliant chefs in the country. It's only 17 seats, like El Bulli in Spain, where you get multiple courses. And I would say 3/4 of the things I had there, I've never had anywhere else.
You're talking about Dwight being the most incredible, engineer, and he's American, which is striking to me because most of those minds are coming from overseas.
Yeah.
Do you think at all from a policy perspective about what can be changed to facilitate that?
The single thing I would like government at the national level to do is to be more flexible on immigration. And it is absolutely crazy today that there are unbelievably talented people in computer science who live in Pakistan or anywhere in the world, but yet can't come into the United States because they would, you know, join a company like ours and maybe eventually spin off and start their own company and create huge value. And we're keeping them out of the country. And all that does is mean that companies will start will outsource more and more because you have to go where the people are. There are only so many talented computer science graduates. And the question is, as a country, do we want jobs here or do we want them elsewhere?
You've been increasingly active in New York government. Mm-hmm. You're an advisor to Governor Cuomo and Mayor Bloomberg. Your company is called Alley Corporation for Silicon Alley, New York. What is your allegiance to New York City?
Yeah, so I feel very passionate about the success that that New York is having in the tech world. My companies have all been located here. And so it's gratifying to see that, for example, people who worked at DoubleClick 10 years ago who have then gone on to start other companies that have been extremely successful or have gone on to be venture capitalists and are investing in other companies. And so you're watching this ecosystem get built up 30 years behind Silicon Valley. But I think you're going to see in certain subsectors of the internet that New York is much more important than Silicon Valley is, actually.
How come?
Because you got to think of the internet's not just one industry. So, for example, if you're starting Gilt and you need people who are buyers, who have 10 years buying merchandise and know the women's market, you can't start that company, you know, in Pittsburgh. You've got to start that company in New York. When I started Business Insider, it needed to be in New York. There are more business journalists here than there are anywhere else. If you want to start a music company, it's actually here in New York or L.A. DoubleClick needed to be in New York because the ad agencies are all here. So I think in all those subsectors, you're going to see New York be the leader, you know, 10 years from now in many parts of the internet. Silicon Valley was very important, and the word silicon is crucial, because it was, you know, for making chips, they have all the talent there. And but that's actually not really part of the industry I'm in.
I wonder if we should call it something else, Alley. What is it?
Well, we a bunch of us were part of the sort of using Silicon Alley early on, so I don't think we have a better one. But it is a good point.
In addition to launching all these companies, you exercise mm-hmm. Frequently. What kind of exercise do you do?
Yeah, so I've always done a lot of different sports. Big skier, having grown up in Switzerland. I do triathlons every year. So probably the quirkiest thing that I'm known for there is I'm a competitive ping pong player. I have a ping pong table at home, and I even play with friends, and even will sometimes have a professional coach come over, but play with a guy called Musa, who was in the Olympics 15 years ago. One of the things that I am known for is maintaining a good overall balance in my life. You know, I take my kids to school 3 days a week. I've always taken at least 5 weeks vacation. Even when I was doing startups, even when we were going public, things like that. And I always stay in shape. Startups can be very stressful. You know, you have a bad day. Rather than kicking the cat, you know, going for a 6 mile run is a better way of, you know, letting go.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
My guest has been the internet entrepreneur, Kevin Ryan. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. you know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and then to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding, you know, what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And I, you know, in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top-performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly. And it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. And then also I'd raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm. So,
and so then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the Academy off the ground or to make the idea of the Academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. One was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for the campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Hmm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle. And she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that.
And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she, you know, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing. And, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, like about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she started, she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.